mighty oceans roar at his name. The wind stands still at his name. The eagle takes the sky.
Soul, my Savior God, to Thee. A beautiful special. I'm glad the younger guys moved this thing because I was getting worried I was going to have to move it on my own. Before I introduce our speaker for the day, this is the saddest part of the reunion that I dread. And it's not because... I knew that was coming. Okay, the second saddest part. No, but this is the part where it's the final sermon for the reunion. It's the final hurrah for all of our brothers and sisters. And now, after this, we got to go back to reality. We're going to be faced right back into that world that's out to get us. And that's the sad part of a reunion. I think it's been a beautiful, beautiful reunion. And I think this has been the best Phoenix reunion that I've been to. And I just wanted to share that with everybody. Our brother Brian... we've known for almost 4 years now. And I was new into the religion and had no idea what path lied before me. And I know I've said this before at Phoenix. I've said it before in Missouri. I've said it at our local. And I asked Brian, I said, when do you know when it's time to be baptized? And Brian told me, you'll know. You'll know. And he was right. And then when we found out today that our brother Travis was going to be baptized, my heart could not stop pounding. Because that's what we're here for. We're here to teach others that are searching and seeking to find the Lord. And Travis, job well done. and all the people that helped him through this. Job well done. But with that, Brian, his teachings and his perseverance with me and asking questions has put me where I'm at today too. It was God's help. And I want everybody to, if you have cell phones or pagers or whatever, please turn them off. We're going to have our hands full with the electronics that we got over here right now. And I just want you to clear your minds of the outside world, because we're not out there yet. And I want you to open up your hearts. And with that, I'd like to introduce our brother and our speaker, our last speaker for this reunion, Apostle Brian McIndoe.
Good evening. Uh-oh, I scared you all off. Good evening.
Good evening.
You're all dreading it too, I can see. It's okay. I've had that effect on people. There's three things that absolutely amaze me. And I was thought about them while I'm standing back there. And one of the three things that absolutely amazes me, is that even though it's been quite a while, I'm amazed that I am standing before a congregation of people, especially at a reunion. Before I get up here, and I'm sitting in the pews thinking about it, I still don't believe it. I sit there in the pews and I go, it's not really going to be me up there. It's not going to happen, It's the real me is still inside there somewhere, and it just amazes me. Another thing that absolutely amazes me is that when we come to a reunion like this, and I know I used to worry about it, but we come to a reunion like this, and people, every opening comment, every sermon, most of the testimonies have common themes. The things that you plan to speak about are taught by the first guy, the second guy, the third guy, everybody. They're just teaching it over and over again, saying everything you were going to say. And I used to worry about that. You start scratching scriptures off. I can't use this. He just used it. And now I sit there going, if I come in with something completely different, I must be off base, The Lord had a message for us. And so I started watching, listening to all the speakers. And probably every thought, every reference that I took to out of my sermon, somebody else put in theirs. Every time somebody says, I wanted to read this, but I didn't, I have in mind. And so all the thoughts that I have today, you've already heard. If I eliminated everything that you've already heard today, I'd have a 10-minute sermon. Guess what? You're not going to get a 10-minute sermon. When I took a class on how to teach, and they said that for somebody really to learn something, you need to hear it 7 times. So you've heard everything I'm going to say twice, so I can repeat myself 5 times today so you can get this message. When Bob called me and asked me to preach, he said, it's the last sermon, Brian. There is no time limits. You can go as long as you want. And I noticed Bob was sick this morning. I thought, he got cowardly and wasn't going to come after saying a statement like that to face you. But it amazes me when I hear that the Lord has placed a common theme on people from around the world at a reunion, at a group of people. Then the third thing that amazes me is that I and you have to worry that I might speak too long. That amazes me. I never dreamed that I'd have to worry about speaking too long in front of a congregation. But I don't make any hesitation to tell you that I don't know how long this sermon is going to be, but I have, I have slides. I can't just skip them, we're going to have to go through it. So I call you to have courage. Courage. Now, you may wonder, You may wonder, what exactly does it mean by courage? What does it take to have courage? And I'll give you an example. In Africa, we have all these churches about this size, but there's never, ever a clock hanging on that wall. So I never know how much I'm preaching. I mean, as far as I know, I'm preaching 10, 15 minutes. I don't know. But the last time when we were there, Joel and I were there, and we were at Mississita, and Joel was asked to preach. You know, they have an elder in charge, and I won't preach there unless the elder, you know, it's a congregation, it's a local, unless they ask us. I said, you know, I assume you're preaching, Michael, and you didn't ask anybody. He says, Joel, I'd like you to preach. Well, Joel showed up there at Mississita, and they had a couple, three congregations there. More than 100 people, more than it's here. Probably half again as many people are here. And Joel had a lot to say. Let me just say that. Joel had a lot to say. I think you know what I mean. And Joel had to have everything he said translated for him. And he sat down. They applauded. We were all happy. And Michael stands up. And, you know, this was after they sang all their songs and gave their testimonies and everything. And Joel made his sermon. Then Michael stands up and they sing a few more songs and offer a few prayers. Then Michael goes, he says, now, we thank you for this service. Now, what we're going to do is I want you to pretend that you just had lunch and now we're in our afternoon service and Brother Brian is going to preach. That is courage. You know, you don't have to deal with me. Joel's not going to preach after me as far as I know. So, you know, now I've just wasted 5 minutes, you know, and that's the way it is. But, you know, have courage. I hope that what I brought today is beneficial for us. I remember our brother Marvin. He used to always summarize everything everybody said, and really my sermon does that. I don't really have to tell you what Alan said and whoever preached. I don't remember. Those guys that preached, you know. I don't have to tell you what they said. I started taking notes, but that would just extend my sermon. That is what I have today. The same type of message. I thought I was reading in the Bible, and God told one of his prophets, Jeremiah, that he knew him while he was in his mother's belly. And he sanctified him for the work to speak the words of God to the people. Jeremiah was fearful. He was a very young man, and I didn't research it to find out just how young he was, but he was a young man. And he said that he was just a child. He says, I can't speak these words to these people, Lord. I'm just a child. I'm too young to speak your words. God told him, he says, I command you to do it. I command you to. But he gave Jeremiah these words of encouragement. He said in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 8 and 9, he says, be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee, saith the Lord. Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. And I hope that the Lord has placed his words in my mouth today. I have a few things that I put in my sermon, I yanked them back out, I put them back in, I yanked them out. Now they're penciled in, you know. And the reason I kept pulling them out, because I'm fearful. They're difficult things. They're troubles within the church. I've heard our brothers keep talking about it during this time. They weren't quite as blunt as I'm going to be. But that's why Jeremiah was fearful of Israel. You know, the Lord sent his prophets, says, don't be a coward. Tell the people the way it is. Hopefully they'll hearken. We know that they didn't hearken too well. We know they didn't like Jeremiah too well. They did some pretty bad things to him. But I hope that I'm not a fear of your faces today. I hope I can say what's on my mind. I hope the Lord puts his words in my mouth. I keep having ideas and thoughts as the reunion went on. That just kind of built on my sermon. Didn't necessarily make it any longer, but I really appreciated the things that were said. And I hope that I can express what I want to today. And I just have some pictures that I hope that will help illustrate what I'm trying to say. And at the last minute, I came up here and did something on my computer. And now I'm thinking of what I saw. And I'm thinking I saw that my pictures weren't in the right order. That I'm not astonished by, that I'm going to have a technical difficulty here. That I expect. But we'll make do with it, and we'll start right here. Here is a picture of two men. The man in the red is a Maasai. The man in the blue shirt is a Kisi. They live on the borders of each other. Anybody that really, really understands Kenya would interpret this picture a certain way. They would envision that this picture would be similar to this. A couple of men that were fighting over food and fighting over territory. Because you see, Maasais and Kisis do not get along. For many, many years, they've been fighting over the boundaries. They've been fighting over the food, especially when there's a shortage. The Kisis are farmers. And they plant food, and the Maasais come in, and after it grows, they want to take the food. The Maasais sell their cows to the Kisis, and after they raise the cows, the Maasais come in and want to take the cows back. They just don't get along. And so you show a picture of a Maasai and a Kisi face to face. What most people would expect is that there is a dispute. There is a problem. They are contending with each other over some issue. Food, territory, superiority, something. But the crux of my sermon is about these two. The crux of my sermon is about unity. Unity. I think that that's what the church needs, is unity. And what the underlying theme of this whole thing that I keep hearing come out constantly, right up to the baptism service, Joel said it, that we have to have humility. Last night I thought, Frank isn't going to preach my sermon. He's talking about hope. He gets halfway through. He says, we can't have hope without humility. All of these things that we're taught, all these aspects that were brought to us require humility. If we want unity, we have to be humble. I hope that as I go through this, I can explain to you why you have to be humble if we are going to come to a unity. The man in the red. Well, first off, the man in the blue. They're not disputing. They're Maasai and Kisi. They're not disputing. What we have here is the man in the blue. That's Elder Moses Uhuru, a Kisi. The man in the red is Paul Koyok. Yes, it's Placido's African brother. And he's a Maasai. He is the leader of the congregation in Kericho. And they are discussing how to further the work in Maasai land. There is no dispute there. They are two different tribes. They're two different people that think differently, live differently, and yet in the gospel of Jesus Christ, they have come to a unity of purpose, of desire, of belief, of faith, and they are working together. The little child hanging off of Moses there is Paul's child. They are friends. They are good friends. Every time I take someone to to Kilgore's, one of the Keesies, they say, I never realized I'd ever be sitting in the home of a Maasai. It's shocking to them. It's shocking. They couldn't believe it. But that's what we have to come to, is a unity, even though we are different people. So my sermon is about this need for greater humility and unity within the church of Christ. You know, there's a tendency in the world for people to jump between churches. This church today, that church tomorrow. Nobody wants to stay put in one place. And it's not because that they haven't found the truth, but if they don't like what the preacher's telling them, or if he's telling them things that's hard or difficult for them, they're going to go find some places that they'll give them something easier. That is a tendency there is. And we as a people, as I grew up and as I see us now, I don't see that we as the Church of Christ have that tendency. I think it was Mark today in his testimony says, there's nothing you can do to drive me out of the Church of Christ. And I think that's the idea of most of us. We will not move out of the Church of Christ. But if we're not careful, we can fall into the same snare that Satan places for everybody else and jump from church to church and do the same things without ever leaving the Church of Christ. If we pick and choose who we'll come and listen to when they're preaching, what's the difference than if you're jumping from church to church? If we pick and choose the congregations that we will attend, if we don't like something they're doing and we refuse to go there, what's the difference? We haven't come to a unity. We're looking for somebody that will do what we want to do. If we earmark our tithing for some special project instead of giving it to the church and trusting the men that we elected to use that money and trust the men that we gave the responsibility to oversee the use of that money, we're just like the rest of the world that jumps from church to church. We are not unified. Pride, which is a hard heart, is what brought about the demise of Jerusalem being a great nation, the children of God. Stubborn minds was the downfall of the Jews, even though God sent his prophets to warn them to soften their hearts, to come unto him, to follow his commandments, to humble themselves, and to turn to him, they would not. I'd like to continue to read from the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 7. And I'm going to read verses 23 through 26. It says, but this thing commanded I them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and ye shall be my people. And walk ye in the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well unto you. Sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? Isn't that what we are to do today? Obey the voice of God, walk in his commandments, and he will be our God. But we continue in verse 24, it says, but they hearkened not, nor inclined their ear, but they walked in the counsel and in the imaginations of their evil hearts, and went backward and not forward. Since the day that your fathers came forth out of the land of Egypt unto this day, I have even sent unto you all my servants and prophets, daily rising up early and sending them. Yet they hearken not unto me, nor inclined their ear, but hardened their necks, and they did worse than their fathers. I have heard. I don't even know if these men know they said it. But I knew that was the whole intent of my sermon. And I know that, and the reason I say I don't know if they said it, because I felt when they said it, they were speaking by the power of God at that very moment. And they were saying, we have to move forward. We have to go up another rung. We have to move, advance, grow. Over and over again, everybody that spoke to us told us, we have to move forward. But when we look at the Jews, what happened? It says they went backwards because they hardened their hearts. Because they were a stubborn people. They went backwards, not forward. And that is what we need to do today. We are Christ's church in the last day. And it is incumbent upon us to move forward. But what they were was stubborn, hard-hearted, rather than humble believers that would follow God in spite of everything that He had done for them. I'm going to continue in Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 5 and 6. I'm going to go read through 8. But I'm going to read this, verses 5 through 8, but I'm going to make some comments through it. So if you're following along, expect me to stop now and then. So Jeremiah 17, 5 through 8. It says, Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man and maketh flesh his arm. What he's saying here is, cursed is a man that trusts in other men, making flesh his arm, his strength. If we are depending upon the words of man or our own ideas or our own concepts of what is right and wrong and what we should do, then we're cursed. Our trust has to be in the Word of God. Our trust has to be in the power of God and that this is His church and He's working among us. So if we put our strength in ourselves or in any other man, then we're cursed. So then, whose heart departeth from the Lord? Verse 6, he shall be like a heath in the desert. You know, if we put our strength in ourselves, or if we put our strength in man, we're going to be like a heath in the desert. Well, good for them. What in the world is that? I had absolutely no clue, but I knew I didn't want to be one. Do you want to be one? Does anybody want to be a heath in the desert? Surely somebody in here knows what a heath in the desert is. I do, because I looked it up, and I'm going to tell you. Here is a heath. It's a conifer. It's a juniper. It's a Christmas tree, okay? I know you'd catch on sooner or later. And I just broke my PA system again. That's not going to stop me. This is a juniper. This is what he's talking about. If you put your strength in man, you are going to be like a juniper in the desert. And it says, and shall not see when good cometh, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness and a salt land and not inhabited. What is the problem with a juniper in the desert? You know, I broke this off of a limb in my own yard, and I live in the desert. But the problem with it is when he was talking and Jeremiah was talking, is that this requires water. It requires water. And if it doesn't get us water, the needles will fall off. And a heath is a naked juniper. Naked. The needles have fallen off of it. Well, you know, when we were in Nairobi in Kenya in January, we came out of Nairobi and we started down this escarpment. And just outside of Nairobi, before you get to the escarpment, is this area that is full of junipers and pines and all kinds of conifer trees. And they were all beginning to dry up because of the drought. And they were turning very gray. And it was a whole forest, a dense forest. And they were graying. And I was worried. It was a beautiful drive, and I was worried. Because a conifer If it loses its needles, it will never grow again. If I would just take and strip these needles off of this branch, that branch would be dead. If this would never got water and all the needles turned gray and dried up and fell off, it would die. It would never grow again. It's saying it's like a juniper that's in the desert. It's not getting water. And so it's going to lose its needles. It's going to lose the ability to continue to grow. And it says, when you see and shall not see when good cometh. So when you have a juniper, a naked juniper in the desert, and it loses its needles, and then the rain comes, that's the good it's talking about. When the rain comes, it's not going to see it, because once those needles are gone, they will never come back. It's gone. It's dead. And that's what he's telling us. If we put our trust in man, we're going to be like a naked juniper. When the Lord pours out his blessings, we're not going to be able to receive them because we're already going to be dead. Unable to receive. Now that I have this up here, I used this early in the sermon because now if you fall asleep, I can use it to swatch you to keep you awake. And I promised Alan I would do that if he fell asleep, so... Let's continue on. Verse 7, Jeremiah says, blessed is a man that trusteth in the Lord, and whose hope is who the Lord is. For he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, and that spreadeth out her roots by the river, and shall not see when the heat cometh, nor her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought. Neither shall cease from yielding fruit. I took this picture. I don't know if you can see that very well. There's a little tiny guy, which is me, right at the base of that. Right down there at the bottom. That is a big tree. It's in a valley in Tanzania. And as you see, it's right by a body of water. And it's a huge tree. Because it receives water constantly. It's a tree by the water. The prophet compares us to a tree planted by the water, constantly nourished, growing strong, and bringing forth fruit. It brings forth fruit. What are the fruits that we are to bring forth constantly? If we are constantly nourished, there should be something upon us. All the time. And those fruits, one of those things are the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Do you find those type of qualities in proud people? Meekness, gentleness. Now, proud people aren't like that, are they? You ever met a proud person? They're usually pretty arrogant. They're not meek and gentle and full of goodness and peace and joy. Another fruit that we will bring forth in every season, if we're like a tree planted by the water, nourished, is converts to the church. Bringing others to the fullness of the gospel, showing them the straight and narrow path that leads to salvation. Those are fruits that will come. That is the commission of the church, to bring forth fruits for the master. To labor in the vineyard. You know, there's a prophecy. My father likes to talk about it very often. It's a prophet Zenos in the parable of the vineyard, the parable of the olive tree. And Jacob, chapter 3, verse 137, he says, go and labor with your mites. Bring forth these fruits unto me. The reason to bring forth fruits is to serve the Lord, to bring people to God. And if we fail as a people, as a church, to bring forth fruits, or to labor for God, or to have love and joy and peace and meekness and kindness and gentleness and joy, it will not be well with us as a people. Jesus spoke a parable to the people when he was here, who thought that his kingdom was going to come immediately. And so he told them a parable. And he told them a parable about a noble man that had to go away for a time. But he was going to leave his things, his talents, with his servants. He was speaking this parable of himself. We know Jesus is going to leave, but he left his church and he left them talents to do things with. And then he would come back at a later time to find out what they had done with it. And in Luke chapter 19, verses 12 and 13, it says, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and saith unto them, occupy till I come. That's the call he has for us today. We have to occupy. We have to labor until he returns. That is what is required of us. And if we read, we see that he gave his servants 10 pounds. And he entrusted it with them. Some of the servants gained 10 pounds with their 10 pounds. And he was pleased with them. Others gained 5 pounds with their 10 pounds. And he was pleased with them. But there was one that just set it aside. And he came back and he had nothing, no fruits gathered for the master. Had not done anything with it. He brought forth nothing. And that was not okay with him. That was not okay with the master when he returned. He took what he had and he gave it to the others. Not everyone is going to bring forth the same amount of fruits. Not everyone is going to convert 100 people or 5 people or 50 people, but every one of us has to occupy as the church of Christ to bring forth these fruits of the Spirit, to show others, to witness to others, to share the things that are entrusted with us. And that is the truth of the gospel, the fullness of the gospel. Those are the things the Lord left with us. And it is required of us to occupy and to use it while he's away. And the Lord himself will bring forth the fruit. Paul, just like Jeremiah, said, I have planted, Apollos has watered, but God gave the increase. God gives the increase. If we are doing our duty to occupy and to labor, to spread the gospel, to witness to our brothers and sisters, to invite people to church, to be an example for others to see the hope that is within us, God will bring the increase. He will make it happen. I'd like to compare us to another tree. This is another tree. This is a desert tree. It's an acacia. It grows all over eastern Africa. Gosh, I don't know. It could grow over southern Africa and a lot of other places. Very similar to a tree that grows around here. But this is an acacia tree, and it grows. And they're usually, not always, but they don't have to be near water because they are a desert tree. And they have very long thorns on them. And they have very small little leaves like our mesquite trees, very similar to them. So a lot of times they grow in groups like this. They have large roots that reach out to gather the water that comes. There in Africa, they're they grow out in a canopy, kind of flat and canopy, and it helps to shade the ground, to keep the water from evaporating, so that they have the roots have the ability to gather just absolutely as much water as possible so that they can survive. And they have thorns on them, 1 to 2 inch thorns, to keep the elephants and the rhinoceroses and the other browsers. I found that an interesting word. Browsers in Africa does not mean somebody that's on the internet. It's animals that eat off of trees, where grazers are animals that eat the grass. But they have these long thorns to keep the browsers from eating them. But this acacia tree that we're looking at here has an enemy. A menacing enemy that could destroy them completely. Quickly destroy them. Make them completely disappear off the landscape and be gone. This adversary of the acacia, it combs the savannas looking for these acacias. And it waits to prey upon them and to kill them and to eat them to the ground. The locals have a name for this predator, this monster that combs the savannas of Africa. And it's called Twiga. The name itself just instills fear into you, doesn't it? You know, this is a monster that weighs 4,200 pounds. It can be 17 feet high. And he's out there to kill the acacia trees. And there he is. Unlike the other browsers, the Twiga, yeah, you know him. I have for those who are listening to a CD and don't see the pictures, I have a picture of a giraffe up there. And that creature does not have any effect about those big, long thorns on that tree. It has a tongue about this long, literally. I know, you can't see that either, can you, on the CD? About a foot and a half long. And it has lips, and it just gets in there, and it starts ripping leaves off those acacia trees. And those thorns do not bother its tongue or its lips. But let me tell you a little more about this giraffe. The giraffe is a kind of a unique animal. It spends its lives in herds of 15 or 20 other giraffes. I hope those of you that know me well, take notice I wore a giraffe tie today at church, just preparing for this sermon. You know, I think ahead. That's what I'm asking us to do today, is think ahead for the work at hand. But this giraffe, 10, 20 of them in a group that live together. And they comb the savannas, eating acacia trees. The male giraffe could be as much as 17 feet tall. And it can weigh as much as 4,200 pounds. The giraffe, here's what's unique about him. You know, not that there's a lot of 17-foot tall animals out there, but the giraffe, who is a mammal, in a 24-hour period of time sleeps anywhere from 10 minutes to 2 hours at the most in a day. Some sleep only 10 minutes a day. Can you imagine living? I'd love it if I could live on 10 minutes of sleep a day. But that's all he does. Sleeps 10 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, the most, 2 hours a day. The rest of the time, like a good teenage boy, he spends eating acacia trees with his 10 to 20 buddies standing around him, devouring acacia trees. Now, if it continues to eat, it gets to a nice stand of acacia trees and it begins to eat and continues to eat upon a big tree like that, 20 of them, it wouldn't take long for them to destroy the trees. to eat it right down to the ground, strip every leaf off of it, then go to the next tree and strip every leaf off of it. And then just continue to eat their way. And of course, this would be detrimental to the acacia trees, and it would also be detrimental to the giraffe because it would have no food left. And it would bring forth the extinction of the giraffe, and it would destroy the forest of acacia trees there. But remarkably, God has put in a safety measure to ward off the destruction of these trees, which also wards off the destruction of the giraffes by destroying the trees. And so there is a safety measure placed within these acacia trees, and that's what I want to explain to you. You see, when this giraffe, like this one you're looking at here, comes up and he begins to browse on a tree, he begins to eat. He begins stripping leaves off the tree. Another interesting thing is that the males are taller and they have a tendency to reach up and eat the tops of the trees, and the females are shorter and they have a tendency to go down towards the middle and eat the middle of the tree, so they don't even eat in the same places. But they begin to strip off the leaves of the acacia tree. Now, if you had a nice turkey dinner sitting there in front of you and you started eating it, would anything cause you to move on until you were full? Probably not. You just sit there and you continue to eat till you're full. Well, these things are going to eat 23 hours a day. So what do you think is going to happen to this acacia tree? It's going to get destroyed right there by this one giraffe. Could eat that whole tree in one day, less than a day, because it could just rip off leaves, just many leaves at a time. But as it begins to pluck off leaves, as soon as it begins stripping leaves, the acacia tree takes notice. It senses somebody is stripping my leaves off. Somebody is attacking me. Well, it knows it can last a little while. I don't know how much a tree really knows, but somehow this tree realizes it's okay for a few leaves to be stripped off. But after 10 minutes, if those leaves are still being stripped off, the acacia tree begins to produce a sap, some type of hormone within it that sends a bitter sap throughout the tree to all the leaves. And within 20 minutes, that tree is completely bitter. Nasty tasting. No longer does that giraffe want to eat that tree because this sap is there. Scientists have discovered the sap is also toxic. If they continued to eat it, it would kill the animal. But as you can see here, there's plenty of acacia trees there. And so when it gets bitter, it's no longer a sweet leaf. It's time for the giraffe to move on to another tree. Now, to me, that sounded quite unique. That's a true story. Quite unique. But what's that have to do with us? Are we supposed to produce sap, you know? Now we're sappy enough, aren't we? But not only does that acacia tree, here's what I want to like to bring about us. Not only does that acacia tree produce this hormone to ward off that giraffe to protect itself, it also sends out an airborne signal of some sort. I don't know how. Some type of hormone that triggers all of the surrounding acacia trees to also begin producing the sap. So, 10 minutes of the leaves being stripped off, it begins producing a sap. Also sends out the warning to all of its brothers and sisters around, saying, produce sap, we got an enemy in our midst. They begin producing the sap, and in 20 minutes that tree is no longer tasty. And so the giraffe, he doesn't just turn around to the next acacia tree and start eating it, because that one's not tasty either. And so he moves on to some distant place. That's why when you're looking for giraffes, it seems like they're always moving. When Dwayne and I took Dwayne to Africa the first time, I said, you know, this is an area. It's full of these little thorny acacia trees. I said, this is the area where there's a lot of giraffes. I said, we may or we may not see them because they don't seem to hang out here. Well, I didn't understand this concept at the time. So we drive through the first time, and there's a giraffe out there forever away, you know. You could just barely see this little neck. But the next time we came through, they're standing right there next to the road. It's because they're constantly moving, trying to find a tree that hasn't been notified that the predator, that the enemy is there to devour it. Like the acacia tree, we have to be aware that there is danger, that there is an enemy out there that wants to destroy us completely, that will strip us right down to total destruction if we let it. That enemy wants to devour us. You know, in the book of Revelation, chapter 12, verse 17, it says, and the dragon was wroth with the woman. And we know in the church of Christ that woman was the church. So then went to make war with the remnant of her seed, and to which kept the commandments of God and had the testimony of Jesus Christ. Satan was angry with the woman, with the church, and made war with the saints, those who had the testimony and kept the commandments of God. When we look at this revelation, and if we believe that it's in chronological order, we understand that this is dealing with the time the church fell in 570 AD. So maybe you're not worried about this. Well, that was many years ago. But my belief is this is still going on. I don't think Satan has given up. He's still angry with the woman. He's still angry with the church. He's still going to make war with the saints that keep the word of God and have the testimony, the truth, the fullness of the gospel. And who is that? That is us. That is us. We are the people that Satan is going to make war against because we have the fullness of the gospel. And if he's able to capture us, he wants to capture us. He wants to conquer us. He wants to destroy the believers because if he does, he will defeat Jesus Christ. Remember Jesus? Gordon read it. He says, I will build my church. And he made a promise. The gates of hell will not prevail, will not win. But if Satan can devour us, then he has defeated Jesus Christ. So, you know, God cared about the acacia tree. He was able to tell them, I'm going to give you some tools to warn each other so that you are not destroyed. I think God probably loves us more than he does an acacia tree. We are his people. We are his special creation. And so he has given us these tools also to protect ourselves. Protect ourselves against the enemy of our soul. And we have to be keen on protection against this evil. So as remarkable as it sounds for the acacia tree, it's even more remarkable of what God has done for us. His people, his special creation. We are the only ones on this earth that have the intelligence to understand and know that there is a supreme being, that there is a creator that is there, that has created us and loved us and has made a plan of salvation for us. Unlike any other animal in this world, he's given us a mind to understand his laws and his commandments and what we are to do. He has given us his word and preserved it for our use that we can read his laws and his commandments and we can read those things. Not only could man talk to each other and explain it, they were able to write them down. And hundreds of years later, we could go back and read the very words of our Savior Jesus Christ and the witnesses that had followed him and talked to him and were instructed by him. And we can understand those things, those little scratches of black and white on a paper make sense to our minds. That's even more remarkable than an acacia tree sending out a signal to its other acacia trees. God has given us a special gift. Our brother received what today? He gave us the gift of the Holy Ghost to speak to our mind, to tell us when the evil one is there to devour us and to take us away into paths that we should not go. He tells us to flee so we are not destroyed. Flee the enemy. Flee the temptations. Put up your guard. Go and find help. God has given us those remarkable tools. In the book of Helaman, chapter 5, verse 85, it says, "And now remember, remember, my brethren, that whosoever perisheth, perisheth unto himself. And whosoever doeth iniquity, doeth it unto himself. For behold, ye are free, ye are permitted to act for yourselves. For behold, God hath given unto you a knowledge, and he hath made you free." We have that ability. If we don't follow use the tools that God gave us, if we don't follow the leading of the Spirit, it's because we're resisting those things that God has given us to protect us, to help us. We, as a group of people, as a body of people, need to be like this acacia tree. We cannot do it alone. That is something else God gave us. He gave us brothers and sisters to help us overcome Satan, overcome the world, overcome ourselves. But we need each other. That's where I say we have to have unity within the church. I cannot do it myself. You cannot do it yourself. We have to be unified and help each other to resist the enemy that we have. Moroni 6:7, it says, "The church did meet together often to fast and to pray and to speak one another concerning the welfare of their souls." They met together often to speak concerning the welfare of their souls. Jim, he read in James, you know, the church met and they spoke concerning the welfare of their souls. And they prayed for one another. The Lord has called us to be a group of people. He said there in Moroni chapter 6, he said they partook of the communion, the bread and the wine, in remembrance of the Lord. And they were strict to observe that there should be no iniquity among them. In other words, throughout the scriptures, we're instructed to come together as a group, to strengthen each other as a group, and to watch over each other. To make sure that none of us go astray, that we walk astray. And when you see your brother walking astray, are you going to be quiet about it? If that acacia tree refused to send out the airborne signal, the next acacia tree would be eaten. Are we too good? Are we not as good as an acacia tree? Let's tell each other. Let's help each other. I'd like to turn to Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. It says, "And let us not be weary in well-doing. For in due season we shall reap if we faint not. And we have therefore opportunity. Let us do good unto all men." That's what our call is. We are to do good unto all men. But if I continue reading, it says, "Especially unto them who are the household of faith." Let's do good. I think it was Brother Allen was talking about the good that we have to do in this world to the people of this world. And he tells us we have to do good, but we have to begin, especially amongst the household of faith, amongst our brothers and sisters. This idea, this word used by Paul here, the household, invokes the thought of a family. A family unit. That's what we are to be, is a family unit. In our houses, in our homes, among our families, we feel safe. We still feel secure. We feel that we are secure from the rest of the world that is out there to take advantage of us. But our family is there to be our loved ones and to be our protection and to be there to help support us, encourage us, and guide us, and strengthen us, and correct us. And that's what he tells us, the household of faith. In our homes, we know we're amongst loved ones who have compassion for us. That is the household of faith, our church. This faith that he's talking about is the believers. This is a family. This is a household. This is a group of people. And when we have the opportunity, especially amongst our own brothers and sisters, do good. Strengthen them. Bless them. Encourage them. Help them. Support them. And sometimes we have to overlook and excuse each other's faults and shortcomings. You know, and I think about my household. Any of you guys that just been married recently, probably gone through this. Us guys that have been married a long time have gone through it for many years, and our wives almost have us trained. They train us, but they excuse us, you know. The household of faith, you know, they don't just beat you up and throw you out because you didn't fold the towel right in the bathroom, or you didn't polish the faucet, or you forgot to put down the toilet seat. You know, they lovingly train you to do those things which are appropriate in your household. And they excuse you and they continue to love you. Whereas Satan would have us be critical. He would have us to be accusatory and make accusations and cause distress, distrust, and argue to get our own way and to be right in all things and at all times. That's why I say we have to have humility if we want to have unity. Because we are a group of people. And when we are dealing with people, we have to have humility. If we're going to submit ourselves to a higher power or to authority, we have to consider ourselves of lower esteem. That requires humility. You know, in the Spirit, if we're going to submit ourselves to the Spirit of God, or to the ministry, or the various offices of the ministry, or the pastors, or the leader, or whatever the case is, submission of a man or a woman requires humility, to put yourself at less esteem than them. So it requires humility on our part. You know, that's pretty easy to be humble if the minister's telling you exactly what you want to hear, isn't it? It's easy. If people agree with your idea and your way of thinking, it's pretty easy to say, I'm humble. And I will accept what they're saying. But humility is not isolated to only the times when everything is going according to what we are thinking. Over the years, I have heard ministry preach about the need for humility. And I stand before you today and echo this call that we as a people, if we are going to be unified as the body of Christ, if we are going to receive all the blessings, if we're going to be like a tree by a river of water, then we have to become more humble than what we already are. I'm not trying to cast accusations. I'm saying we have not reached total humility yet. And I'm using the word we. I understand myself also is in this category. But how do we accomplish this? How do we do it? One mindset we can have to be humble is that others always come first. People, other people are always first in your mind. Jesus gave us some direction, examples of humility in Luke. I'm just going to read them real quickly. I know they're very common to you, but I'd like to read them because it tells us how we are going to be humble. Luke chapter 6, verses 27 through 36. It's the words of Jesus. He says, "But I say unto you, which hear, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, bless them that curse you, pray for them which despitefully use you, and unto him that smiteth thee on one cheek, offer him the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid him not to take away thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee. And of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye? For sinners also love those who love them. And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same. And if ye lend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thank have ye? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much gain. But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great, and ye shall be the children of the Highest. For he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. But ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful." You know, if you can actually love your enemies and do good to them who are doing evil to you, that requires humility. You know, he's given us some pretty hard extremes, but he's kind of given us a mindset that everyone comes before you and me. And with that mindset, it brings us to humility. King Benjamin addressed the subject in Mosiah chapter 2. I'm going to begin at verse 20. It says, "Even so I would that ye should remember and always retain in your remembrance the greatness of God and your own nothingness and his goodness and long-suffering towards unworthy creatures. And humble yourselves even to the depths of humility, calling on the name of the Lord daily, standing steadfastly in faith of that which is to come, which was spoken by the mouth of the angel." I'm going to go to verse 24. "And ye will not have a mind to injure one another, but to live peaceably and to render to every man according to that which is due." Verse 27 through 29. "But ye will teach them to," speaking of the children, "but you will teach them to walk in the ways of truth and soberness. Ye will teach them to love one another and to observe one another. And also ye yourselves will succor those that stand in need of your succor. Ye will administer of your substance unto him that standeth in need. And you will not suffer the beggar to put up his petition to you in vain and turn him out to perish." I'm going to drop down to verse 43. "I would that you should impart your substance to the poor, every man according to that which he hath, such as feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the sick, administering to their relief, both spiritually and temporally, according to their wants. And see that all these things are done in wisdom and order, but it is not required that a man should run faster than he has strength. And again, it is expedient that he should be diligent, that thereby he might win the prize. Therefore all things must be done in order. And I would that ye should remember that whosoever among you that hath borroweth of his neighbor should return the thing that he borroweth according to that he hath agreed, or else thou shalt commit sin, and perhaps thou shalt cause thy neighbor to commit sin also. And finally, I cannot tell you all the things whereby man can commit sin. For there are divers ways and means, even so many that I cannot number them. But this much I can tell you, that if you do not watch yourselves and your thoughts and your words and your deeds, and observe to keep the commandments of God and continue in the faith, as what you have heard concerning the coming of the Lord, even to the ends of your life, you must perish. And, old man, remember and perish not. Really, King Benjamin summed up this idea of humility in one sentence. Chapter 1, verse 49 says, "Behold, I tell you these things, that you must learn wisdom, that you may learn that when you are in the service of your fellow beings, you're only in the service of your God." If we put everybody else first, then we will become humble. We are called to be servants. I looked up quickly, servants. You know, it's used 900 times in the Bible. We are to be servants, slaves to our fellow beings, to our brothers and sisters. King Benjamin was the king over the people. Most kings go in and they become dictators, they're rulers, people work to serve them. But King Benjamin says, "I come to serve you." That is the call of the Church of Christ. That's the call of your ministry. Not to be lords over the people, but to serve you. That is your call to your brothers and sisters. To be in service to each other. To labor for each other. We have the truth of the fullness of the gospel. And if you wish to serve others, you have to share it with them. To possess something and not give it to others is not a service to them. You have to share it with your family, with your neighbors, with your co-workers, with the world. It's not to say that you're all going to be missionaries, but you all have these opportunities to share the truth of the gospel. And we can accomplish this burden if we work together of taking this